Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Devron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week of November. This week, we're very pleased to have wildlife biologist Scott Gremmel joining us. Scott has worked for Olympic National Park for many years on various projects and is here to speak with us today about one of his favorite topics, the birds and other wildlife species found in non-forested habitats in the park and beyond. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. You will probably guess the family that this animal belongs to, but identifying the species will be quite a bit trickier. A big hint is that it's associated with one of the habitat types that we will be talking about today. We'll play it again and tell you more about it at the end of the program. So, Scott, what have you been seeing out there?
Well, I took a minute to stop by the lagoon in town this morning, which is always a favorite stop of mine. Mainly looked at the waterfowl. Probably the best place in the county to see ruddy ducks.
Oh, so lots of
ruddy ducks back in the corner. And a few other waterfowl that I haven't seen yet this fall. Common goldeneye, and I saw my first Eurasian widgeon mixed in with all the American widgeons. But it's always a good stop on the way to the co-op.
I mean, it's actually an amazing resource there.
It really is.
Years ago, there were a bunch of bats.
We went to look at the bats.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the process, saw like a dozen Virginia rails.
That's right. Yeah. So it's a cool spot.
Yeah.
Oh, you also saw, weren't you telling me about a golden eagle that you saw up in the park?
Yes, up at Hurricane Hill in the park. There's a small population of golden eagles in the high country in the northeast corner of the park. And you sometimes see them around Hurricane Hill or Klahani Ridge area. And we got a great look at one a couple of weeks ago, kind of from above, perched on a rock outcrop where you could really see the golden nape on the back of its head.
Well,
and watched it fly away.
But do we get breeding populations here?
There probably are breeders in the mountains. There's not a known nest site or anything, but now and then they'll breed out on the coast in like big clear cuts, big open areas. They'll find these little spots where they key in on mountain beavers
and wow.
breed, and then the forest will grow up and they'll move away. But definitely in the high country and probably breed up there. We just don't know exactly where.
The only place that I've seen them on the forest that I know of was up at Tyler Peak, which seems like perfect golden eagle habitat.
That whole zone is good for them.
Yeah, they're magnificent birds.
Yes.
It's been so mild out this November. I mean, usually it's really rainy and windy. It's like the rainy and windiest month in our area, but it's been so mild.
It's been quite kind so far.
It has been, I know. We actually found the latest chanterelle mushrooms that I've ever found a couple of weeks ago. Mushrooms are still eking out a living
there.
It's
still late fall.
I know, yeah. It's a good thing. And hopefully some of you out there were able to catch the Leonid meteor showers this past weekend. November's wonderful Leonid meteor showers happen every year around November 17th or 18th. As our world crosses the orbital path of comet Temple-Tuttle. And like many comets, Temple-Tuttle litters its orbit with bits of debris, and it's when this debris enters the Earth's atmosphere and vaporizes that we see this meteor shower. In 2018, the peak mornings of the shower were expected from midnight to dawn on Saturday, November 17th, and Sunday, November 18th.
Something else to keep your eyes peeled for during the month of November is the planet Venus, which will appear increasingly bright, shining at its brightest in late November and early December. Given an unobstructed view of the horizon in the direction of sunrise, you'll easily see Venus blazing away in the east an hour before sunrise. Venus ranks as the third brightest celestial body to light up the sky after the sun and moon. Our thanks to the site earthsky.org for keeping us current with what's happening in the skies above us.
Yes, indeed. So I first met my guest, Scott Gremmel, in connection with studies of wildlife species dependent upon threatened ancient forests on the Olympic Peninsula. But today we'd like to focus on the importance of non-forest habitats for wildlife in the Olympics, habitats that can be just as threatened as our old forests are, but for very different reasons. So when we talk about non-forest habitats, what exactly are we talking about?
Well, the group of habitats that I'm thinking of are often burns or immediate post-burn young forest, meadows, both low elevation and high elevation meadows, large-scale blowdown events where big windstorms have taken down lots of trees and created shrubby openings, avalanche chutes that are maintained by heavy snow avalanches, and prairies in the low country, basically meadows, and a few others. But those are the main ones that we think of occurring in our natural areas here.
Uh-huh. So why are you so interested in these habitat types?
Well, full disclosure, we both worked on spotted owl projects for a really long time, and I was
and
in the woods
like,
all the time.
I need to get, to,
to, get,
I need
the sun.
To, get to the sun.
But it actually it sort of dawned on me growing up in the East. One of the things that is threatening, surprisingly, a lot of bird species in the East is loss of early successional habitats. So some of the birds that used large patches of forest were actually doing better than ones that required shrubby old fields. And back there, it was a different process. It was that, you know, agricultural fields had been abandoned and they'd grown back up, but that process had kind of played itself out. Things were either being farmed or they were forest, but you didn't have this process of creating openings that were growing back in that things like, say, a chestnut-sided warbler could use. So I think it's a little counterintuitive, but in that kind of a landscape, it was becoming really rare to find those sorts of early successional habitats. And then you'd see the same thing going on out here that, you know, agriculture is, especially thinking of the North Peninsula, there's not a lot of agriculture anymore, which maintained open habitats down low. And then we'd been suppressing fires in the mountains for as long as we could, basically, effectively, since about World War II. So I would go out and do these owl surveys, and you would see sign of old fires everywhere, but you weren't seeing any fires. And, you know, working for the Park Service, I was aware that, you know, we would frequently... not frequently, but we would get lightning strikes and they would be suppressed and then we would all just sort of forget about them. And I grew alarmed that the landscape was changing in a way that we were losing this whole component of young forest and then also this process that maintained species even in the old forest, things like Douglas fir that require fire to regenerate. And so I just kind of became fascinated with those processes that maintain these open areas and how we've affected them.
Yeah, the Forest Service was a little too effective in their Smokey the Bear policy. But, you know, there's such a difference between a fire that humans create versus a lightning strike.
Yes.
Fire.
Yeah, they occur in different places. They occur at different times. They create a very different pattern on the landscape for that reason. Yep.
So, speaking of fire, with the fires currently raging in California so much in the news, we should start with a review of burns. So, burns are unusual in that they're both a mechanism of radically transforming some habitat types and a way of maintaining others, like prairies and meadows, like we talked about. And it's also a habitat type unto itself, a burn. So there's a long history of fire occurring naturally in the Olympics, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And we have sort of our personal and societal level of comfort with these sorts of disturbances. So you know, that's sometimes a fine line between maintenance and catastrophe in terms of these natural processes. If it's a forest type that maybe burns every 3 to 5 years and you're removing the grass from the understory of ponderosa pine, I think people are very comfortable with that. But in a regime like in the Olympics, where you might have a 300-year interval between natural fires, people see that happening and it looks like a catastrophe. It looks like the end of the world because it's, you know, it's a longer time span than a lot of our lives, and we become used to seeing the mountains being completely covered with these huge green trees. So when that changes, that's alarming to a lot of people. So the fire history of the Olympics is pretty variable. It ranges from over on the west side, where there are places that probably almost never burn. It's just too wet. It just doesn't dry out. And those are the places where you wouldn't see Douglas fir trees at all. There just hasn't been an opportunity for them to regenerate for over 1,000 years. And then as you move farther east and also a little bit higher in the mountains.
And on the west side, it's mostly spruce, right?
You get spruce in the lowlands. And then as you get higher, it's hemlock and silver fir and trees that are very shade tolerant and eventually kind of can grow up in the understory and replace themselves without a big disturbance to sort of restart the whole system. And then as you move to the east side, you know, picture walking up the Elwha or the Dungeness, and you're walking through just this ocean of Douglas fir in a lot of places. And most of those are stands that grew up following large-scale fires. So you can get places in the Eastern Olympics that might have burned every 150 years or 100 years, which is still a long time relative to other places in the West, but it's frequent enough that it maintains this younger Doug fir. And then that's just the frequency of fire, but then there's sort of the scale of these disturbances and that kind of the landscape, so that you get patches of different ages mixed together. And so the role of fire has created more of a mosaic over time of different ages and different species, and it just acts.
And that's really healthy for a lot of
wildlife species. It's healthy for a lot of things, yeah. And, you know, one thing about the mountains here is they have a lot of natural barriers, high ridges and things like that. So fires would burn in one drainage but have a hard time maybe getting over to another. So it's less common here that you would see a fire that would burn, you know, across the entire landscape because it's more broken up naturally out there. So fires played a big role in creating the habitats that we see out there. But from, say, you know, the late 30s, 1940 until maybe 2000, we didn't have a lot of natural fires in the Olympics. And that's changed a little bit in recent years. We can go on to talk about that, too.
Is that because the park's philosophy on fire has changed?
Somewhat. Yeah, and probably a mix of things. We have had, that period was probably a little wetter than the period before that, but also starting, you know, I'll say after the year 2000, the park's gone through a whole series of terms to talk about fire. There was, you know, around the time of Yellowstone, there was the let it burn policy, which we're not allowed to say that anymore. And then...
And I should, I don't know if I should interject, but I heard a really interesting talk on fire last night. I was at the Admiralty Audubon meeting, and Varne Brooks gave a presentation on the fire history of Yellowstone. And that fire was in 1988. I mean, it's hard to believe that that was 30 years ago. And we've learned a lot watching what happened there.
Yep. So that sort of morphed into what we would call prescribed natural fire, and then terms became wildland fire used for resource objectives, and then just fire use. And in the current fire plan that the Park Service is revising right now, the terminology is managing wildfire for multiple resource objectives, including resource benefit, which is a real mouthful. But what it means is we treat all those natural ignitions as wildfire, and the response to them is more on a fire-by-fire basis based on where they are on the landscape, what resources are at risk, and what resources could potentially benefit. And in theory, all of that is taken into account as the agency decides how to respond to a fire. So that could mean a fire like the Paradise Fire in the Queets was being suppressed on one flank to keep it from getting out onto commercial forest lands, but essentially being allowed to move deeper into the park to avoid the impacts of fire suppression, which are big, going in and cutting trees and building fire lines and stuff like that, but also to allow fire to play its role in that case, because that was a natural fire.
Uh-huh. But if it were started, if it were human-caused, if it were like in a campground, would the response be different? Well, if it was threatening, it would be suppressed.
Yeah, human-caused fires would be treated differently. If there was the ability to suppress those, they would be suppressed. Uh-huh. But if it was a human-caused fire that escaped and grew large, some of those same thoughts would occur. It would be less in the realm of resource benefit, but more in that realm of what are the resources at risk and where is it just better to just allow the fire to sort of burn itself out in some directions. But uh-huh. Yeah, human-caused fires are treated differently than natural lightning fires.
Uh-huh. Is that policy the same across the board for the national parks, or does each park create their own fire policy?
There's an overarching national fire policy, and then individual parks have what they call a fire plan, which is how they implement that policy. So there are differences in how it might be implemented, but the overall policy and goals and objectives should be more or less the same.
Uh-huh. And speaking of fires that are started, I mean, Indigenous people had a long history in this area of using fire as a tool.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, we can see an example right across the way from the station at the little Kaitai Prairie. They used to burn it consistently for camas bulbs.
Yep. Yeah, and there was definitely a recognition by those groups that you know, by burning these areas, they created different resources that they were able to use and had a more understanding and a probably a different level of comfort than we do with setting fires on the landscape.
So. Yeah, and again, with the Yellowstone fire, you know, it was lack of burning by the Shoshone that created a lot of that monoculture, that lodgepole pine monoculture that then made it such an amazing fire once it got started.
Yep. It had a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah, it did. Yes, indeed. So what's the recent fire history been like in the park since you've been there?
Well, I started in 1994 on the Spotted Owl Project. And also did collateral duty fire starting that year, so I was a little bit involved in that too. But at that time, we hadn't had much in the way of large fires in the park for 50 years or more. And so it was really hard to find places where you could even go out and see recent burned habitats. And like I said, I would see all this old sign of, you know, charring on trees and these owl sites, but you couldn't really go out and find very many places where you could see a recent fire. There was, I guess, Deer Park burned in 88, which was a human-caused fire, but that was getting to be an older burn by the time I worked there. But things started to change, I guess, 2000, 2010, and in that era, the park became a little less aggressive about fire suppression. And I think part of it at that time was less willingness to put firefighters at risk to go out in the backcountry and put out fires that actually weren't doing any harm.
Because that country is so rugged.
It's extremely rugged.
And it's so dangerous in a fire. I mean, the steep sides, you know, having rocks rolling down, everything is so unstable.
And when you run across these old burns in the backcountry of the park, what you notice is a lot of the damage that was done in suppressing the fires, where the lines were dug and trees are cut. And so the first fire that was a little less aggressively suppressed for that reason was probably the Griff fire near Port Angeles, which was 2003. And that was a lightning strike late in the season. It was on a very steep, high slope. And they looked at it and said, you know, it's the fall rains are coming. It's in an unsafe area for people to work. We're not going to send people in to suppress that. And it ended up over the next month or so growing to be about 800 acres. And they managed it in the way I described earlier. There were, you know, sprinkler lines were put in on some flanks to keep it from getting too large or growing towards Port Angeles or getting too close to Hurricane Ridge Visitor Center. But the initial decision to not go in and suppress it, you know, accepted that we would probably burn more acres than you would have if you'd, you know, sent in smoke jumpers and tried to put it out at 2 acres. And then eventually that was an area that I did a bunch of ecological research, and it was really interesting to both be able to be on that fire. I worked on the fire lines on that fire, on a fire crew, and then to be able to come back for 10 years after that every year and see these places that I'd actually watched burn recover and see what species come back to do it. So.
Well, Varn had some cool photos in the show yesterday about how, like, just the spring after, it was all green. Yeah. And within, like, 2 years' time, it was favorite habitat for a lot of species.
Yeah, and I guess another thing I'd say about the fire history is we have had quite a few fires in recent years, but if you add up all the acres that have burned in the national park since we've become a little less aggressive at suppressing them, it's still less than 1% of the forested area of the park. So it may loom larger in people's minds, but you know, the acreage that's been burning on a per year basis is probably still less than it was historically because we've put a lot of fires out in these recent years too. So we're allowing fire to play its role more than we did in the past. But I think people shouldn't be alarmed that the whole park is somehow burning up because we're not putting these lightning strikes out as regularly as in the past.
Well, and the timing of them, I mean, usually the times that they go off or like in the late summer, and then the rains come and you know, take everything down.
Yep.
So it makes perfect sense to just monitor them and make sure that they're not getting out of control, but let them do their thing.
And it's a very conservative policy. If something is near the boundary of the park, those fires are suppressed. So the ones another good example was the fire up at Hayden Pass, which was 2 or 3 years ago, that got to be close to 3,000 acres, burning up in subalpine fir forest and subalpine meadows. And, you know, that's in a place that's 20 miles from the park boundary in about every direction. That's a really safe place to allow, you know, fire to open up those habitats and without worrying that it's going to escape the park. So.
Uh-huh. Great. Well, and the question that comes to everybody's mind, though, is whether there's been an increased incidence of fire in the last decade or so that's linked to climate change. Probably you can't really
say. It's hard to separate that from the change in firefighting strategy.
Yeah.
You know, if we had been doing the same thing for the last 100 years, I think we still would have seen a slight uptick because we have had some very dry summers these last several years. But, you know, I can think of 15, 20 years ago, we had some extremely dry summers and we had a bunch of lightning and crews went out and they put those lightning strikes out and nobody thinks about them again after that. So several of these larger fires were ones that I think would have been suppressed 20 years ago or dealt with differently.
Uh-huh.
So it's a mix, I think, of less aggressive suppression and some drier summers, which could be a trend or it could just be a natural variation. It's hard to say at this point.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, we have sadly run out of time for this month. We're going to have to pick up on part two of this interesting conversation next month. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, Deborah.
It's the week of the Thanksgiving holiday. There are none of the usual scheduled natural history events to tell you about. Your event will instead be to eat a lot of turkey and take a nice hike around the neighborhood to walk off your holiday feast, or, you know, between the main course and the dessert course, take a little hike and make room for pumpkin or pecan pie. So here's our mystery sound again. And Scott's going to tell you a little bit about it.
So the mystery sound is the three-toed woodpecker, which is found in burns in the Olympics. The first calls are its regular call notes, which sound sort of like a hairy woodpecker, but a little more hollow. Then that rattle is very distinctive, doesn't really sound like anything else out there. And the drum is different from the other woodpeckers in that it is fairly brief, it's slow, and it tapers off at the end. So it's a series of fast drums and then sort of dies out at the end, and that's different than the other woodpeckers that you'd hear in the Olympics. So
the three-toed woodpeckers they come in after a burn. I mean, mm-hmm. they're specialists.
They are specialists, right? And they're present here in the forest, probably in very low numbers, using, you know, there's dead trees in the forest. But where they really, their population really increases is if there's a big die-off. And so where we find them now is in burns, and then we also find them, there's a lot of mortality in subalpine firs in the park right now, probably due to warming, drying summers. So at lower elevations, subalpine firs are dying out in some big patches. And if you get into those patches where maybe half of the subalpine firs are dying, we found three-toed woodpeckers actually nesting in those habitats.
Cool. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, Ryan Merrill found the first nest in a long, long time on the Obstruction Point Road, ways out that road in dead subalpine firs a number of years ago. And then the bird crew has found other nests on the east side in similar habitats. So that's an important habitat for them too.
So do they migrate into the area, or you think they just kind of retire back to the forest?
Yeah, I think there's low numbers in the forest, and they key in so fast to these. You know, we worked a little fire over by Deer Park. It was a 1-acre fire in lodgepole pine, and I went back the next year one time, and I found a three-toed woodpecker in that tiny little burn surrounded by, you know, tens of thousands of acres of green forest.
Wow, so, that's cool.
So they key right in somehow on those sites.
Oh, that's great. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the third week of November. Thanks so much for joining me, Scott. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. Wishing you all a very happy Thanksgiving, including time to recognize all the many things that we have to be thankful for in our remarkably beautiful corner of the universe.
Today's show was engineered and edited by Nora Petrich. The following is The Woodpecker Song by Kate Smith.
Just listen to that tick-a-tick-tick-tick.